Mammoth
Audio. This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. I have a love-hate relationship with the 2013 magician heist movie, Now You See Me. On the one hand, it's a film about four bank-robbing magicians and the FBI agent hunting them down. What's not to love? On the other hand, there's something about this tale of unbelievable heists that is, well, unbelievable. In this week's episode, co-host of the weekly Planet Pop Culture podcast, Nick Mason, helps me unpack Now You See Me, celebrating its successes and poking holes in its plot. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. I'm talking today to Nick Mason from the Weekly Planet podcast. Thank you for joining me, Nick.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here and bring down the tone.
Bring down the tone.
Well, it's all you've got magicians talking about their craft, and you've got
criminals and
criminals.
You.
Yeah, and me.
And you.
Yeah.
Last guest on the podcast was David Kwong.
Oh, what an odd coincidence.
He was head magic consultant, was his major.
Correct. I'm aware.
As well as doing a whole lot of things on the movie Now You See Me. And he said that one of the things that he said about the film was that it was always meant to be, everyone, when they were discussing it, was this is magicians as superheroes.
Oh, interesting.
And When I think superheroes and I think podcasting, I think The Weekly Planet.
Oh, yes.
And I think Nick Mason.
Yes. So, because you haven't listened to any other superhero podcasts.
No, it is the only one I've listened
Excellent.
To.
Excellent.
And even that.
Default. Even Here we that, go.
Even that one I drifted in and out
of. Yeah, no, that's fair.
I should also point out that we're also joined today for the first time on Scammapalooza by my daughter, Beatrix, who is just 2 years old and is sitting with us eating some crayons. Thanks, honey. Can you spit that out, please? Can you spit that out? No, are you going to swallow it?
Just for the record, this is not theatre. She actually did eat a crayon in front
of us. She really did eat a crayon in front of us.
Crayons are non-toxic these days, right?
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
So we should point out the reason why we're talking about Now You See Me.
This is your favourite film.
It's not my favourite film, but it is a film that sums up and encapsulates like everything that I love. So it's a heist movie.
Yep.
It is a magic movie. Mm-hmm. It's got knots and twists and turns and should be the ultimate film for me. And yet I have, there are moments in the film that I absolutely love that I think are beautiful, but then there are moments in the film that fill me with rage as a viewer. And it's that passion that I want to explore today.
Oh, sure. Okay.
The only other film we've discussed so far on the podcast in great length has been Nightmare Alley, the 1950s film noir classic.
Oh.
So this is a much more modern film about a much more modern subject.
This is pop culture detritus in a way.
Indeed it is. So we should say straight up front that we are going to spoil the movie.
Absolutely.
So when the movie was first sort of released, I got very excited because the idea was that it was Ocean's 11 with magic.
Even the poster looks very Ocean's 11. We have all the major cast members sort of doing a
Reservoir Dog style.
There
walk.
We go. That's
Indeed.
What I'm thinking of. Yes.
And we're watching from above, and there's the car native. So it's clearly wanting to be Ocean's 11 with magicians. Mm. And I got very, very excited about it.
Uh-huh.
I was at the Melbourne Magic Festival, and I was
emceeing,
as I am, and I was emceeing this big stage gala.
Uh-huh.
And the publicity people had given some Now You See Me posters. And they said, oh, can you just give these away at your gala show? And I was handed these posters and was expected as MC to hand them out to people, because people want marketing material given to them in the middle of a magic show.
Uh-huh.
And I went, oh, great, so they're supporting the film, the magic festival.
Yep.
No, they just want us to give them out, and we agreed.
Sure.
Yeah.
Also, can you fire this T-shirt cannon into the crowd?
If they had given me a T-shirt cannon with T-shirts, that at the very least would have been entertaining.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like the first time I saw the movie, I went in with a certain amount of frustration with them. What's the plot? How do you describe the plot in
the plot,
premise?
The plot is that there are four street magicians. They're very low level magicians. They're borderline criminals.
Mm.
A couple of them are anyway. And they are all approached by some sort of mysterious man, who.
In a hoodie,
sure. The most mysterious garment of them all, gives them each an address of a card with an address on it and wants them to seemingly initiate them into some sort of magical, mystical order, which we later learn is called the Eye, an ancient order. And then 1 year later, we see them and they've become sort of super high profile Vegas magicians who we don't really see what they do prior to the events of the movie. We just know that they're big.
Mm.
And then once they've got this huge inbuilt audience, they start performing Robin Hood style, robbing from the rich, giving to the poor.
But you're missing the important thing. They're doing it using magic.
They are doing easy magic.
Magic tricks. Yes.
Yes.
And the film opens. And this really got me excited because it opens with a beautiful magic trick, which is a deck of cards is
is sort of riffled to you, the audience, at home. Yeah. And you look and you're asked to remember one card.
And we do.
And we do. And then the cards are thrown in the air and the camera pans back and there is a skyscraper with written in the lights of various offices, Seven of Diamonds.
And that is the one that I thought of.
That was the card I was thinking of. And when I saw it at the movies, the audience, members of the audience gasped, which is a really hard thing to do when you're watching magic on the big screen.
Yeah.
That was very impressive.
Can we go back one? The first perhaps inkling that I had that this movie wasn't particularly great is that if you go back a couple of seconds, you see Jesse Eisenberg with a deck of cards and he's surrounded by just a field of enraptured, beautiful women who are hanging on his every word. And they're like, oh, he's been entertaining us all night with his magic. And we're all aflutter.
That's right. And that's the thing, I think, that goes, the film sort of goes back and forth between those two elements. Like,
yes.
It goes back and forth between being...
Magic is sexy.
Magic and sexy.
And magicians are massive nerds.
Yeah. The Jesse Eisenberg is there as the smug, mid-range, mid-level, close-up magician who... And he is surrounded by many, many beautiful women doing card tricks. And for me...
He's doing the card tricks. The women are not doing
the women are not doing the card tricks, no. But the women are in love with him. And when he performs this incredible Seven of Diamonds effect, the woman who he's doing the card trick on literally tears off her clothes and tries to bed him.
Oh, yes.
Right there on the spot. I mean, I realize the idea is you want to present this idea of magic as being, you know, sexy and fun and flirty. But there is an entire subculture of pickup artists who use magic
that's
to pick up
true,
women.
That's true, yeah.
And that's where my brain went.
Oh, yeah.
It just made me feel a bit grotty. Mm. I think he was my least favorite of the magicians.
Interesting.
Because we also then have Isla Fisher, who is
Australia's own Isla Fisher, yes.
Yes, and she is a sort of
until she does something bad,
yes,
and then she's out.
That's right.
We'll find another culture that she belongs to and we'll ship her off to that.
Like we do with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a sort of an escapologist. So she, in the films, and this is one of the things, she gets locked up, dropped into a big chamber of water and is supposed to escape before a timer runs out. And man-eating piranhas are dropped on her and she fails and the piranhas are dropped on her and she gets eaten alive and turned into blood. But then she turns out she's in the back of the room.
See, this is our first instance of CGI. Anything in this movie, I think. Apparently, they were using real piranhas. They shipped in some real piranhas. They weren't big enough.
Is that for real?
Yeah, they weren't big enough or impressive enough. So
they used the fake ones.
The fake
instead.
Ones, yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Because the moment I see the fake piranhas or the CGI piranhas, and as soon as I see CGI magic in a magic movie, my brain just sort of switches off.
Fair enough.
Much in the same way as it does when you see CGI action versus sort of practical.
Oh, definitely.
Practical special effects.
You see.
There's the difference between watching The Thing and The Thing.
Oh, sure, yeah.
The original John Carpenter Thing had real stuff you can touch. The second one, it's CGI. And so it doesn't feel right. It just feels grotty.
But I did also read that Isla Fisher, in doing that scene, did get trapped in the box. And so there was... But I often wonder when they do this sort of movie, you know, when there might be a rom-com or something like that and they cultivate a fake romance between the two leads in real life and they... send that to the tabloid press or what have
you. And like with whenever they have the you know, any of those kind of poltergeisty type movies, they always talk about weird happenings on
set. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
The Curse of the Exorcist.
Precisely. Yep. And I wonder if they're just like, well, what could go wrong with this? Let's just say it happened. It works better.
I thought you were suggesting that someone rigged it to...
Oh, to kill her.
Possibly kill off.
Maybe. That would be better.
And replace her with another actress and with the dead one.
Rose Byrne.
Rose Byrne.
Yeah.
There's always
the poor or possibly rich man's Isla Fisher. I don't know which.
There's always a Rose Byrne in the wings. Mm. I feel the most likable. No, of course, the most likable was, speaking of poor man's actors, the poor man's James Franco. Dave Franco.
Yes. You found him the most likable.
I found him great. I liked him. So he was he's a street magician.
Yes.
That's a proper street magician. Doing a bit of spoon bending.
He's borderline just stealing from people.
And then he starts stealing from people. So he steals someone's watch, and their wallet, I think. After badly performing a magic trick.
Uh-huh.
That's all right. And then finally, Woody Harrelson.
Sure.
Who is...
he's definitely Woody Harrelson, isn't he?
He is definitely Woody Harrelson. And he's both a... He's a mentalist.
And a hypnotist.
And a hypnotist as well.
Uh-huh. Those things go hand in hand in real life, do you think?
Yes. Yeah, they do. Because both mentalism and hypnotism, the idea is that you're talking about psychological effects. The idea of just using your brain or your mind to perform the magic you're doing.
When we see... When our first appearance of... And this didn't ring true to me, but maybe I'm completely wrong. The first appearance of Woody Harrelson, he is performing some sort of hypnotism/mentalism trick on a couple.
Yeah.
And he reveals that the husband of the couple is cheating on his wife with the sister, I think it is. And but he has also hypnotized the wife so she cannot move, even though she's filled with rage at this adultery or what have you. How realistic are we talking for that?
Not realistic at all.
Right, okay,
because the thing with hypnosis is, the idea of hypnosis is it's the placebo effect.
Mm.
The idea is if you believe that you're going to be hypnotized,
yep,
you will be hypnotized.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to stage hypnotists, and this is like the big secret to stage hypnotists.
Oh, here we go. Here we go, listeners.
When you go and see a stage hypnotist, you know, so they bring up like 20 people on the stage and they'll start hypnotizing them one by one. If they're a really crappy hypnotist, they will just have stooges. They'll have actors and say, "Here's $20, just act like a chicken."
Yeah.
But what a lot of them do is that they basically, so if I put you in a situation where you're up on stage.
Oh, yes.
Everyone's paid all this money to see a hypnotist and I say, "Okay, you're feeling sleepy, you're going to go into a trance," and you're not really feeling it.
Yep.
Your instincts as a decent human being is, I'm just going to go along
with it. Just play along. Yeah. Everybody's come here to see a show.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So they play along.
Right.
But when it comes to the actual hypnosis, you can sort of talk someone into a trance.
Uh-huh.
You can make suggestions to them, but it's very difficult to suggest that they would do something they wouldn't normally do.
Correct. So you're really enraged at this person. Don't attack them. Probably doesn't hold water.
No.
Is there a hierarchy of magical performers? If you could rate these three people, like who's the king and who's
when it goes mentalist, hypnotist.
Yes.
Well, look, I think it would. Mentalists like to put themselves on top.
Uh-huh.
Magicians quite like mentalists. Mentalists don't like magicians.
Okay,
so
sure.
It seems to be thing. And I think it's because mentalists don't want to be seen as magicians.
Okay,
they
sure.
Want, because mentalism is believable. If I tell you I can read your body language and I can implant thoughts in your head and I can hypnotize you, that all feels real.
Uh-huh.
I can pull a rabbit out of the hat, you know that's fake. Sorry, mentalists try and distance themselves from magicians. And,
yeah.
And this is the thing with Woody Harrelson is that what he does throughout the movie, he says at one point mentalism is, you know, it's a bit of cold reading, a bit of body language, a bit of hypnosis. Mm-hmm. And he's pretty spot on. It's a bunch of sort of weird psychological tricks put together and then conflated on stage with a big theatrical performance to make you feel like it's more impressive than it really is.
Mm.
And so watching him, you know, just throughout the film go, it becomes, I guess, superpowers.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Which me as a magician who wants, I want the stark reality of magic, I find that frustrating.
Right.
But I think a regular audience will go, oh, really? Oh, you know, they think of the possibilities.
But let's say a magician is given multi-millions of dollars worth of technology that he can perform the tricks, he can light up the Empire State Building or what have you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's more a bribe sort of situation. But, you know, some of the tricks we see later are clearly you've just been given an enormous pile of money and you've produced this. How do you feel about that? Is that...
Oh, as long as it's entertaining, I don't
care
how much money. Anyway, so our four magicians are... They're approached by a shadowy figure via weird tarot cards and asked to go on an adventure. And the next thing you know, they're performing in Vegas. They bring a Frenchman up on stage, a randomly selected Frenchman up on stage. They put him in a box and say they're going to transport him to a bank.
His bank in France,
his bank in France. And the next thing you know, he's in his bank in France surrounded by money. And then suddenly...
He pulls a lever of some sort or he pushes a button. It vacuums up all the money.
Exactly. Vacuums all the money and the money is suddenly now in the theater in Las Vegas. Everyone's been showered by all the money in the bank. The owners of the bank walk in and there's no money and the money has completely vanished.
And leaving only the card that the French gentleman has signed.
Yes.
He's a very famous French actor, apparently.
Oh, is he?
He's not... Apparently the French Tom Cruise wasn't available, so he is the next best thing.
Okay.
Perhaps the French...
Robert Downey Jr.
That'll do it. Okay. Sure.
So, and of course, now the FBI are involved, and this is where Mark Ruffalo... I refuse to call them by their character names.
No, that's fair. Yeah.
This is when Mark Ruffalo enters the scene with his...
He's a perpetually harried FBI agent.
Yes, who's just angry.
Yeah.
And he's angry... And should we just say it up front? Because I think it's going to annoy us later on. He is, in fact, the mastermind behind the whole
thing.
Yes, he is. He's the one responsible for everything. And his reasoning and how he did it is sort of slowly revealed throughout the film.
Yes, absolutely.
And the fact that it's him at all.
But he is putting in... Ruffalo is, like, I like Ruffalo as an actor. I think he's great. This performance is a fairly stock standard performance, but the FBI agent persona is putting in a command performance because he is this FBI character even when nobody is looking.
Yeah.
Even when it's only the people, even when it's only the other magicians that he's dealing with.
Yeah.
He's never a nod or a wink. He's always totally on board, even when he's clearly alone.
Yeah.
Even when he knows no one is watching him, there are points in the film where he puts on this persona and then he'll sit down and he'll be leafing through a, you know, a book of magic or something like that, and another character will come in. And you go, well, he's put on the persona because he knows at some point they'll come in, and that's part of it. But there are definitely scenes in the movie where there's no chance of anyone catching him not being this FBI persona, and he's still carrying it off.
Yeah. He also sort of acts erratically, accusing other people of being involved in the, like sort of, you know, particularly his Interpol partner who's appeared out of nowhere and is very sweet and very suspicious because of that. Mm-hmm. And he keeps accusing her for no reason other than to really throw us, the audience, off a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's something which I think is a very magician-y thing to do.
Right,
is to try and throw people off the scent in a way that is... for a magic trick is perfectly acceptable because there's, you know, anything I can do to make you not look at the right thing is, you know, even if it's a tiny little thing, it's perfectly acceptable. But in a narrative and in a story where you're going to reveal the secret at the end, I think the audience has got to feel like they're in with a chance.
And there's no chance here.
Yeah.
There's no little ticks. There's no, I mean, it is a movie that in rewatching it, you see why he acted in certain ways, but there's no, upon first watching, there's no way. It's very much, we're dropped in it right at the end. Oh, he was the mastermind all the time.
Yeah.
Here's a couple of scenes where we see the back of the man, the front of the man in the hoodie, and he's giving the card, and oh, it is Mark Ruffalo, but there's no way we could have known that.
No, that's right. So he's basically pulling the strings and helping out the four horsemen, these four magicians, pull off these incredible stunts. Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of periphery characters. You have Michael Caine, who is bankrolling the theatre production.
Yep.
And he seems to be quite beloved.
Yes.
And you also have Morgan Freeman, who is a failed magician who's now revealing the secrets of magic via selling DVDs and makes millions.
This is back in the day when you could sell a DVD.
Yeah.
It was right at the tail end, I feel.
It must have been. He talks about downloads and selling these DVDs and making literally millions of dollars from the secrets of magic.
Mm.
When really you could just go on YouTube and find out some 12-year-old's theory.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Anyway, but that's fine. It did make me feel like there was very much an intention to make a Christopher Nolan film, having both Morgan Freeman and Michael Caine. It was very Batman Begins with magicians.
Yeah. What did you think of The Prestige?
Loved The Prestige.
Interesting.
Absolutely loved it.
Can we spoil The Prestige? Why not?
Sure. Well, I think the difference between the Prestige is the characters are magicians, but it's not really about magic.
It's more about the dangers of obsession.
That's right.
And cloning machines.
And cloning machines.
Yeah.
And when it gets to the big cloning machine, there's very little CGI in that film. The magic that they show you is real and practical and could actually work, and the historical elements are all real. So I feel like that stands up as a film.
Right.
And thinking back, you can go, aha. Of course, that all makes sense when it's revealed. Uh-huh. Yeah. What's interesting is they have a voiceover say, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the four horsemen. Uh-huh. And they walk on stage.
Yes.
And then Isa Fisher says, and for our final trick.
Yeah, interesting.
So it's a weird 5-minute show, which, I mean, it's a good trick and everyone can make money. So no one's going to walk out disappointed, but it's very odd, this little 5-minute trick.
Uh-huh.
So the FBI start investigating.
You would like the stage to be littered with.
Yeah.
The remnants of their other trick. Lots of scarves that don't end.
So the FBI come in and Morgan Freeman is brought in to help out, and he points out exactly straight away how the trick is done. So he says that there's a secret that they've already robbed the bank earlier, replaced the real money with fake money.
Flash paper
money, which is real money. That's a real thing. You light it, doesn't leave any residue.
None at all.
No, well.
Even multi-million dollars.
Multi-millions, there's going to be some residue, but it leaves a sort of a smoke and an oily residue that no one can ever see. It's amazing stuff. There's a magic shop in Sydney called Hey Presto Magic that imported a bunch of cheap Chinese flash paper.
Oh, sure.
Whole joint went up in smoke.
Oh, boy. Whenever there's a fire in a building, arson is always suspected. Imagine a magic shop that went up in flames. That is arson times 10.
Well, this was the basically what happened was someone ordered a bunch of flash paper. He brought it in, imported it, and the guy never came and picked it up, and the shop went up in smoke. And if you did that in a bank, it is going to go up in flames. But I feel like as a movie watcher, I feel like that's a quibble.
I feel this opening gambit is quite.
Yeah.
At no point do I think. Well, there's an element to it, but we can probably get to that. But it does feel like
it holds up.
It's a trick that's rooted in reality, and you see how all the steps were built.
Yeah, so the Frenchman doesn't really go to France. Instead, he's basically dropped into a room, a duplicate safe beneath the stage.
And they got his signature by Just looking at his credit card receipt, which had his signature on it.
Yes.
And I guess that's close enough to pass muster,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And it kind of, yeah, I mean, that's a little bit dodgy, but again, that could kind of work. The big thing that doesn't work for me is the idea that they implanted the idea yes. that he should go to...
Again, Woody Harrelson's magic mind control powers.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Because to me, if you have that ability
yep.
very early on, and if you are trying to get revenge on people who have wronged you in the past, which is what the film is, it's yep. a revenge flick, then... And you can control minds. Uh-huh. Surely you just go to the people who wronged, implant
yeah.
the thought, give away all your money now, please.
Uh-huh.
And then they do it.
Yeah.
And it's a boring movie, but it makes more sense as a heist.
Yeah.
But again, you know, we'll keep with the theatricality of it.
Yeah, that's fine.
To me, I mean, that idea, though, when I first saw it, and on second viewing, I was frustrated and annoyed that it's so unbelievable and ridiculous to do that.
Yeah.
But with the idea that David told me in his interview that it was very much about magicians being superheroes and saying, okay, well, this is what we can do now with magic. What uh-huh. can we do in 10, 20 years' time
right,
with magic?
Right, sure.
So it's a bit of fantasy wish fulfillment.
Yeah, if there's been this society that has devoted itself entirely to magic for the last 100 years, then
yeah.
what could they have built, you know, doing that?
Uh-huh. So it's almost as if we're watching science fiction.
Yeah.
And it does okay. feel science fiction. Mm. So they get arrested. You know,
there is the very famous, always be the smartest man
yes.
in the room.
Jesse Eisenberg in the interrogation says, always be the smartest person in the room.
Uh-huh.
As I said to David, surely it should be always be the teenager who didn't have a lot of friends.
Yes, absolutely.
In the
yeah.
room.
Yeah. Always be the teenager who had 8 hours a day to flip a card over.
So they basically escape any sort of prosecution, despite yep. the fact that they did give away all this money.
Yeah,
and
sure.
they steal this money. They get away with it uh-huh. for some reason.
Sure.
And then we're going to head to New Orleans and we're going to yes. do another show.
Mm.
So now they're in this big, old, beautiful theater.
Yeah.
And they're pulling off their second show.
Oh, yes.
And the second show is where we get to actually see an actual show.
Uh-huh.
So they have the mirror box where they produce the rabbit.
Yes.
Which is sort of pointed to. This is where she floats across the audience in
the
bubble.
Yep.
In the bubble.
Has the Spider-Man musical taught them nothing? Don't levitate over the audience. Everyone will be killed.
Everyone will be killed, yeah. So that's it. And in the finale of the thing, and this is where the extra or the bit players really come into their own, because uh-huh. everyone in the audience turns out they're victims of Michael Caine's
that's right.
a company. They all lost money during the Hurricane Katrina uh-huh. when their houses were taken away and the insurance company refused to pay up. Turns out Michael Caine, who is invested in the magic show,
mm-hmm.
is responsible for all these people losing their money.
That's right, yeah.
But the Four Horsemen have managed to hack his bank account.
That's right.
And have transferred the money live on stage into their bank account.
So Michael Caine, up until this point, a delightful charmer,
mm-hmm.
is revealed to be a snake.
This is my favorite, legitimate favorite moment of the film. It's throughout this magic show that they've been performing in New Orleans. Woody Harrelson brings up a bunch of people and hypnotizes them all
uh-huh.
and then tells them that they're all on football teams.
Yep.
And they've got to try and tackle the quarterback.
That's correct, yes.
When they hear the word freeze.
Yep.
And then that's just this one moment in a montage of magic.
Uh-huh. And Mark Ruffalo, who is in the audience.
Yes. For some reason.
Yeah.
Investigating and watching.
Uh-huh.
When it is discovered that all of this money has been transferred to all these people's bank accounts, seemingly via magic,
uh-huh.
he leaps up on the stage and yells, freeze.
Sure.
And then all of the people leap up from the audience uh-huh. who had been hypnotized earlier and tackle him to the ground
because
he's the quarterback. Mm-hmm. And to me, even I've seen it now 3 times, every time, just love that moment. Uh-huh. It's such a, I'm like, yeah, that's what, because it's foreshadowed.
Yes. Okay. Sure.
It's this nice bit of foreshadowing. Did you like that moment?
Look, I did, but again, like I said, obviously, Ruffalo is playing along because he is ultimately the mastermind and he wants this to go exactly the way he wants it to go.
Mm-hmm.
But as a man who's been in the audience and is presumably some sort of FBI agent, criminal profiler who knows what he's doing, he has seen all these audience members be programmed to attack someone who says the word freeze. And then he goes up on stage and he says the word freeze.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Knowing that he's about to be tackled.
Yes.
Yeah. For no reason.
Yeah.
Because he could have just run a bit slower or leapt
yeah.
up.
Yeah. yeah.
And that's part of the thing. I suppose the argument is that
he's the underdog. He's
meant to be the underdog and to those around him that he's you know, really working hard to solve this case. Uh-huh.
Would you like to know a fact about this New Orleans scene?
Yes.
So this takes place in the Savoy Theater.
Mm-hmm.
So this apparently was nearly destroyed by Hurricane Katrina. It was rebuilt. It is only open for sort of movie productions now. So they sort of put it and set it back up again just for the production of Now You See Me. That's not the interesting fact. The interesting fact is that a story circulated during festivals and the press junket that Michael Caine wandered off the set during this scene and ended up spending 4 nights locked in a closet during this shooting.
Why?
I don't know. It doesn't say.
Is this a rumor?
Yeah.
I wish I'd known that before.
The directors deny this ever happened. But they would, wouldn't they?
So he got lost on the set.
Yeah. And just four nights locked in a closet. Which suggests to me that he got out during the day.
Sure.
And then wandered around and somehow ended up getting trapped again three more times.
Yes. That's right. Yes, four nights.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it does feel, I mean, it is a beautiful, again, the thing I liked is that the three magic shows that we see are all very different. You have like a slick Las Vegas one, you have this beautiful old fashioned theater, and then the last one is the hip modern.
Yes,
hip
okay. Uh-huh.
So they've stolen money from the bank.
Yes.
They've now stolen money from Michael Caine.
Wait, who's the hacker on the team?
Who's the hacker who's taken the, there was no need for hacking because the reason
why they gave him the, okay, right on.
The reason why, they had the details was because they
mentalized him.
They mentalized Michael Caine. And the way in which they did that was, Jesse Eisenberg said, oh, I'm going to try and tell you some information about yourself. I bet I know your mother's maiden name.
That's right. Yeah.
And then attempts to guess it and gets it wrong. And Michael Caine says, no,
I bet I can guess your childhood pet. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. All of that sort of information, which were apparently the security questions. Mm. Something that is pointed out a lot.
I would question, but also that's happening live. So there's a tech involved. See, this is where I start to question who else is on board with this because there had to have been someone who's transferring the money at the time.
Oh, yeah, they could have just had it set up with a timer.
Yeah.
Transaction.
And also there should be someone who, but with this kind of big production, there's a lot of people moving levers and dials and stuff. How much do they know?
Yeah, that is true. You don't see a lot of, there's not a lot of, you know, there's no stage manager or director or the publicist.
So do we transfer the stolen money now? Is that what we do?
Yeah, none of that is really, there isn't a whole series of people in the background. No, but I think.
These are the quibbles, but yeah.
I feel like they're quibbles compared with some of the fight scene that goes on that we're about to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, which I think is a major flaw. I think that's a minor quibble. And there is a sense throughout the movie that you are watching a magic show. And in shows, whenever you see a magic show that tells a story, it's always done with broad strokes and it's always done in a way in which you're never really meant to believe it. You're more just meant to sort of accept.
Just go with the ride, yeah.
Just go with the ride, which I know is an excuse sometimes for bad cinema, but in this case, I feel like it's more reasonable to do that.
Are there people that develop tricks but they don't perform them? They're just engineers and they put them together?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they produce them and they market them and they sell them. There's a guy, Rick Lax.
Uh-huh.
He performs very, very rarely.
Yep.
He does YouTube videos, where he sort of performs tricks and he makes and markets them to other magicians who then sell them.
Yeah. Is there a race to purchase the trick, master the trick, and then get it on TV before anyone else?
No, because normally there's TV rights are involved. So most of the time they're not involved. But also what a lot of magicians do is just do the same trick in a slightly different way and no one notices.
Right.
Yeah. At this point, they're now properly on the run from the law. They're in hiding and Mark Ruffalo's at his wit's end, but he manages to track them down to an apartment in New York.
And he does this because he discovers that they have switched out his mobile phone with a tracking device. And we see this on the CCTV footage of Jesse Eisenberg being interrogated. And it is, for a man who is allegedly a king of sleight of hand, it's an incredibly broad...
Sloppy.
It's incredibly sloppy. It is, you'd think for someone who's been planning this, for people who've been planning this for a long time, could have been more subtle. And I know it's movie magic, but oh boy.
Yeah.
Surely that's the first, surely they would review that tape.
Oh, yeah.
Surely, because in that scene, Jesse Eisenberg is handcuffed to it. He's double handcuffed to a table.
Mm.
And then he flings the handcuffs onto Mark Ruffalo's character. And then Mark Ruffalo is handcuffed to the table. You would think somebody, just by, out of sheer curiosity, would rewatch that tape immediately and go, you got trapped by that guy. Let's see it multiple times. And then you would see this incredibly sloppy foreground mobile phone switch.
Do you know what? Like a lot of the time, if you've just done, you know, the swap of the wrist type thing, you can do extraordinarily sloppy sleight of hand. No one is going to be looking. I do a trick called card under box, and it's where you get a playing card, it's signed, and then the audience suddenly look, and it's sitting underneath the card box that's been there the whole time. And the trick is, you put the card under the box. That's it. You just pick your moment, and you do it. No one notices because of the sleight of hand. So, yeah, I think that's believable. But the whole switching the phones and using that to get the... is all completely unnecessary for the purposes of the movie, really.
So we get to the greatest action sequence of all time.
Yes.
Here we go.
Mark Ruffalo tracks the four horsemen to this apartment building.
Uh-huh.
three of them escape, and Dave Franco stays behind.
Oh, hang on, we never finished the hierarchy of magicians.
Oh, magicians.
Who's the worst?
Ventriloquists.
Okay, sure. Yeah. No, I'd agree with that. They're bad.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So they escape, and Dave Franco then proceeds to fight Mark Ruffalo and one of his offsiders.
With a magic fight. This was released prior to the movie. This was a very widely circulated promotional video clip, this magic fight.
It was a big moment.
Uh-huh.
And it's throwing playing cards, yep. And it's lots of
fireballs.
Of fireballs.
A lot of fireballs out of the sleeve, out of the sleeve. Is my favourite.
Yes, it's very Job from Arrested Development moment. And there is another cop in the room, but he then gets incapacitated at one point.
Yes, he's
some nifty handiwork with
a sinkerator.
So he's out of the... He can't really see anything,
uh-huh.
And yet the fight continues, and Mark Ruffalo really fights as hard as he possibly can against a guy that he has employed.
Yeah, that he's employed and presumably knows everything that he's going to do.
Yeah.
And would be prepared for everything he's going to do, surely.
Yeah.
If you can hurl a card to cut a banana in half, you can defend against that.
I just figured it out.
Yep.
The reason why he's doing this
is,
okay, because the whole movie is that Mark Ruffalo is a member of the Eye, the secret society of magicians,
uh-huh.
Right? And the four horsemen of the apocalypse are trying to get into this secret society of magicians.
Uh-huh.
The reason why he fights properly is to test.
See what he can do.
To test Dave Franco. This is one of the tests is to see your magic fighting abilities.
Right, sure.
To see how well you can throw the playing cards and shoot the fireballs.
Uh-huh.
How are you going to do with this?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That works.
That makes sense. But at the same time, when he finally does escape... Thank you. When he finally does escape, Mark Ruffalo in chasing him down. There's one point where Dave Franco leaps through a garbage disposal.
Yeah.
And then Mark Ruffalo's like, "Ooh, this is I don't want to have to do this. I'm against it." kind of thing. And then he felt that there's nobody watching him.
No. So
he should be like, "I guess this is what I'm doing."
That you're right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then this is where the movie enters into. And this is surprising because with all of the sort of magic tricks and the CGI at this point, I kind of went along with it.
Uh-huh.
But at this point, Dave Franco gets involved in he steals a car.
Yep.
Gets into a high speed police chase.
Yes.
And then the car flips and rolls and explodes on a busy bridge.
Yeah, sure.
Lots of people see this and witness it.
Uh-huh.
And it is absolutely horrifying. And then Mark Ruffalo runs in to try and save him. But it's too late and the car explodes.
Explodes, yes.
Now, it turns out this is all fake.
Uh-huh.
Dave Franco is not dead and they've swapped the cars for an identical car. An identical FBI car with a corpse in it. So, that would involve people knowing all this information of the FBI car being there
at
that spot, of him knowing that he can steal it, of no one noticing the two cars being swapped and there being no cameras on the bridge. And most importantly of all, they flip a car down a busy bridge and blow it up.
Yep.
And they're totally cool with the fact that they could possibly kill innocent bystanders.
Oh, so many people, yeah.
So many people could have died.
There's what happens is Woody Harrelson is driving the bus and it has an identical FBI car tow barred to the front of it.
Mm.
So he's presumably just driving it down a freeway
with
a car attached to the front, like a secondary car with a dead body in it. And then he just lets it go with a push of a button kind of thing. And it also involves them setting off and knowing the traffic pattern so well that they can set off at a particular time and know that when they get to the bridge, Dave Franco will have caught up and the good guys will have caught up to a certain point. And also that the French sidekick will also have known to rebel against the command to not leave the crime scene and steal somebody's car.
Yes.
You know, just have an innocent bystander standing around on his phone outside his car. She commandeers the car. She collects Mark Ruffalo. And then they go on this car chase and she's driving. It's not a case of, well, Ruffalo's driving, so.
No, she's the one.
He can coordinate this. She is the driver in this
case.
She's
the driver of the car.
There was a trend after, I think, The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight, because the Joker had an incredibly elaborate plan.
Yeah.
To, you know, cause chaos and kill, Batman's girlfriend and Harvey Dent and make off with all this money and, you know, become the king of crime in Gotham, et cetera, et cetera. And is this incredibly elaborate plan, which involves dozens of, or if not hundreds of pieces all falling into place at the same time.
Yep.
And it sort of implies that if they hadn't, he had another plan, you know, this massive decision tree. And if the plan didn't pull off exactly as he wanted it to, he would have a secondary backup plan for that. And, you know, he's a madman that is operating 1,000 levels beyond everybody else. So this, and I think this is one of the movies that followed on that. We've got to have this mastermind who was in control the whole time.
Yeah.
He had this plan. He had 100 backup plans. It happened in, Skyfall as well. We had another villain who had this elaborate plan to be caught all along kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm. And I think, though, the difference is with this is there's a very clear, specific goal. And there's only one way this can play out, and it has to play out this way. Otherwise, the heist slash magic trick isn't going to work.
Right.
Whereas in Batman, the Joker is just about chaos. And if it had failed, it would have just fallen. You know, he would have gone, oh, well.
Would have just blown something else up.
Exactly.
But that's what I'm saying. They're presumably, in this scenario, there was 100 backup plans.
Mm.
They've planted 100 other corpses in cars. He could drive off the bridge.
Woody Harrelson. Woody
Harrelson just gets to the end of the bridge and he's still got the car at the front of his bus. Yep. Mm.
So now we've got a point where someone is dead.
Yeah.
And I understand. I mean, this is the thing you need to do. It's about, you know, you're rounding to the third act. You've got to raise the stakes. You've got to kill someone.
Yeah.
So they kill off Dave Franco, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
And then they now need to try and figure out the final act.
Yes.
And that's to steal this safe full of money without anyone noticing and deliver it to the people in the same way as they have sort of the previous two times.
Yes. Whose money is that again?
I cannot remember.
No, I can't remember.
The reason
either.
Why I've gotten distracted, I can't remember whose money
it is. I just saw it the other day and I can't
remember. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
And it's just sitting in a building.
It's sitting in a building. There is a reason for it. So there is a safe in a building somewhere for some reason, and they arrive just as they see it disappearing
because
on the back of a truck.
The FBI superior has been hypnotized into both playing the violin and being hypnotized into being completely oblivious to a safe being stolen.
And so he doesn't know.
Yeah. Yep. Again, he's the hypnotism superheroism. That comes on.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so they chase the truck, and eventually when the truck arrives, Mark Ruffalo's there, the police are there, the FBI are there, Morgan Freeman is there, everyone is there. They open the safe and it's full of balloon animals, and where's the money?
Uh-huh.
And what has actually happened is that the safe never left the building at all, and there was an enormous mirror that reflected one half of the room onto the other, which is a trick they'd already explained earlier on.
I did like
the foreshadowing of, let's explain this trick to you, and then we'll use it to fool you later on.
Right.
Which is a nice thing to do.
It is a nice thing. Going back to that, and I thought about it earlier, but I didn't bring it up. We were talking about CGI earlier. There is a, when they did the rabbit trick initially, Isla Fisher does turn a rabbit into a top hat.
Yes.
And it is atrocious CGI.
It is, in my opinion. No, it is. It's bad CGI.
Is that a real trick?
No.
I would imagine there's no fake rabbit that can fold out.
No. There are magicians who've sort of said, you know, look, I'm going to pull a hat out of a rabbit. People have done that as jokes and gags or as actual tricks, but never in that CGI way.
Right,
she's holding an object, suddenly it turns into another object.
Yeah.
It's like a Sabrina the Teenage Witch style.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, late 90s CGI moment.
Uh-huh.
And they're the moments that bring me out of it, that make me go, oh, it doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't matter. It's not real magic. It's not, when I say it's not real magic, it's not real sleight of hand or real illusion.
Yep.
It's just special effects.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, anything is possible.
Sure, yeah.
So I don't care.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that just kept sticking in my head.
Right. And so they built this elaborate mechanical mirror system.
In the warehouse. It only works if you don't enter the room.
Correct.
As soon as you enter the room, you're going to bang your head on a mirror.
Yeah.
And no one enters the room. They enter the room just enough so they don't
bang
their heads.
That's correct,
so they're centimeters away from the mirror and they don't. And that to me is one of the big moments of like, if just one of those people had just taken 3 steps forward, the whole plan would fall apart.
Yeah. There's the scene earlier in the film where they go to the fake bank in France, which is under the stage.
Yeah.
And they walk all the way through it. They look at it. They touch it. They kind of, you know.
Yeah.
There'd be, you know, just forensics people just going, well, it fell through the floor. We fell through the floor last time. Maybe there's a secret door where the safe would be. I'll walk over to it. Oh.
We should point out this time that I'm spooning a distressed child.
Sure.
Who's just not happy with the world.
Do you mean metaphorically?
No, a literal child.
Sure. Okay, great.
Literal child. So at this point, I mean, the money has been stolen via the use of the mirror.
Uh-huh.
And we now go to the big finale. And this is the big finale of the film and of the trick.
Sure.
And of everything and of the heist. And that is that they're now going to distribute the money to the masses. And what we get is a light show projected onto the side of a building.
Yep.
And then we also have the 3 of them, survivors, leap off the top of the building and turn into money. And this is the most clearly CGI'd moment in the film, in that we're not sort of meant to believe that maybe it's done with wires and a special type
of
bubble mixture.
Or they drop through a trapdoor or something
like that. Yeah. No, it's very clearly those people turn into money.
Right.
And that is a kind of jump the shark moment for me where I feel like I can't justify it.
Then again, we're talking about holographic walls. Maybe they leap, they fall through a trapdoor, them turning into money, that's the hologram.
Yeah, but then the real money is released.
Yeah.
Possibly, but even so.
But doesn't it turn out to be fake money? It's got their face on it.
Yeah.
So where is the money?
Well, the real money. Oh, it's no, the real money is in Morgan. Later. Yep. Is in Morgan Freeman's car, and then he is framed for the crime.
Oh yes.
But that's a fairly loose. Like, hey, look, here's your car, and it's full of money. Yeah. Not really enough evidence. That's fairly circumstantial.
Here's a little fact I've got for you in that particular scene. We come back to the them turning into money in a second. The shot of the balloons bursting from the safe that happened, and the money bursting from Thaddeus's car did not go as planned. A crew member was in the safe pushing balloons out of the door, and stuntmen were dressed in money suits to push money out of the car once it opened.
Oh, my God.
Money suits.
I wish, like, morph suits were covered in money, I
guess,
imagine.
So, yeah.
That's
yeah.
great.
Or like a commando who's covered in, you know, brush and grass yeah. and stuff like that. They've just got a whole bunch of money taped to them.
That, to me, both of those moments feel real. They feel like real things that happen.
Sure, yeah.
So, now the movie's supposedly over. They walk off. Into the sunset. They then yep. walk into Times Square and stand in the middle of Times Square,
yep.
Looking at all of the screens which are projected with images of their heist.
Getting away with everything.
Getting away yep. with it. They're the most famous people in the world, supposedly, at this point, but they're standing in the middle of Times
yep.
Square.
That is a direct Ocean's 11 moment.
Yeah.
There's a scene at the end of Ocean's 11 where they've gotten away with the crime and they all sort of walk past the fountains in the middle of Las yeah. Vegas, and they're like, oh.
We did it,
yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so you think at that moment that the movie is finished, uh-huh. and that's when the big twist comes.
Yep.
And it's something that David said that they were actually aiming to do.
Well, I'm fully inclined to believe that, but at the same time, it could have been something that they did at the last minute, and then they just added a couple of scenes.
Well, no, the idea was that in what happens in a lot of great magic tricks is that you are promised one particular trick, and uh-huh. then they deliver another.
Right.
So, for example, I'm going to lock myself in this chamber of water, uh-huh. and I'm going to escape before the piranhas are dropped on me.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out the piranhas are dropped.
Yep.
And they think you're dead, but then you appear at the back of the room.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So this is the appear at the back of the room moment where uh-huh. we find out that Mark Ruffalo is behind it all.
Yes.
And we have a scene in Central Park, mm-hmm. And he reveals his motives.
Yes.
So we should explain. We've kind of left this out because it is not very interesting. It's the idea. I mean, it's not like compared with people exploding into money and,
oh, sure, yeah.
And the quarterback and all of those things. Uh-huh. The idea is that basically Mark Ruffalo's father was a great magician mm-hmm. who all of his tricks were revealed by Morgan Freeman. So uh-huh. he decided to try and come up with the ultimate trick.
He got Penn and Teller'd.
He got Penn and Teller'd, yeah. He tried to come up with the ultimate trick. Uh-huh. In doing so, died.
Yep.
And the insurance company refused to pay out.
Sure.
And it's the same insurance company underwritten by the French bank.
Yep.
And Morgan Freeman was the one who ruined his career.
And the safe that he was in that didn't open because it was poorly manufactured, I think, was the same company of the safe that he stole, potentially? Yes.
Yeah. Now, uh-huh. it's been pointed out, and I have to credit this to Everything Wrong with Now You See Me, the video series.
Uh-huh.
They point out
a whole series.
There's a whole series of things that are wrong with various movies. And they point out that Morgan Freeman is kind of a jerk for revealing the trick.
Yep.
But the insurance company did nothing wrong by refusing to pay out on a man who endangered his own life by locking himself in a safe and throwing yes. himself into a river. I don't think that there is anything wrong with the insurance company going, no, we're not going to pay out on that uh-huh. claim. Likewise, the safe company did nothing wrong at all.
Safes are designed to sit in banks. They're
and
not
be
designed,
safe.
Yeah, and they're not designed to be hurled into rivers.
Yeah, the idea yeah. of like someone locks themselves in a safe, it sounds like a frivolous lawsuit. Mm. It sounds like...
It's like somebody who sued the producers of the movie Drive because she saw the movie and it didn't have as much driving as she thought it would.
Exactly. Yeah. Frivolous lawsuit. And that is why all of the vengeance has occurred, and that's yeah. why Mark Ruffalo has set this all up. He tells the four of them that they are now in the magic. For me, it's sort of ridiculous because I've been members of magic clubs before.
Uh-huh. And of course you have.
Yeah. And to join a magic club, what happens is you show up and yep. you do some tricks for some old men.
Okay.
And the old men go, yeah, that's quite good. I like that. And uh-huh. you're allowed to join.
Yep.
A lot of the clubs now, it's the quality of members. Like there's some, like the Australian Society of Magicians brag about how many members they have uh-huh. because it's so easy to get into.
Oh, of course, yeah.
The magic uh-huh. circle in the UK, that's really hard to get into. Uh-huh. I think for me, the thing is like, this is not a movie about magic and it's not a movie about magic. It is a magic trick.
Uh-huh.
And magic tricks are ridiculous and they don't make a lot of sense and they're meant to be wondrous and wonderful and a
right.
bit silly. But at the same time, magic tricks don't last for 90 minutes.
Oh, yes.
And magic tricks don't promise us a narrative structure that makes sense.
Mm, yeah.
And that's I think, where the movie really falls down.
Yeah, like it's a case of If you, and I've said this about, I'm a big proponent of time travel movies that make sense.
Yes.
They need to have a logical structure.
Yep.
And it's the same with the case of whodunit movies. Mm. If you're watching a whodunit and then it turned out that the killer was the butler, and then you were like, but he was in the other room when the murders were taking place. And people were like, oh, well, why don't you just enjoy the acting and the you know, the costumes and the, you know, the sets and the blah, blah, blah. And it, you know, why can't you just enjoy the movie? Because there's an essential element of things making sense that I want to happen in that movie.
Yeah.
You can't just gloss over those things kind of thing.
But you can in a magic, in a magic show. And I guess that's it, is that the movie isn't sure whether it is a magic trick or if it's a puzzle. But that said, I mean, we sit and we complain and we pick holes in it.
Boy, do we.
So much money.
So much money. There's
a huge amount
of money.
There is a sequel on the way with Harry Potter.
Yeah. Daniel Radcliffe.
Daniel Radcliffe.
The greatest magician of them all.
Yeah. And, David mentioned in our interview that he said it's called the second act, and he said that he's taking that to mean that there's going to be a third act.
Oh,
so
yeah.
There may well be a third one as well.
Yeah.
So that's it. I feel
there's so much more to be said.
There's so much more to be said, but I feel mean.
Yeah.
I feel mean and disingenuous. But to me, I guess as a magician and as a storyteller, there's stuff that just rubs me the wrong way sometimes and I want to get off my chest.
Yeah.
But then I also feel like our opinions do not matter.
Right. Yeah. I feel that I've become more that way in the last few years, where oftentimes somebody will say, oh, my favorite movie or my favorite TV show is blank. And I'm like, well, here's a million reasons why you're wrong. And I'm like, well, just let people enjoy what they enjoy. It's not,
So I guess the takeaway for this, for me personally, is this has not been a review of the movie. It has been very much, like all reviews, it's been more about us than it's been about the movie.
Sure, it's about our insecurities.
It's about our
insecurities. I certainly can't turn a rabbit into a hat.
No,
so.
I can't throw myself off a building and turn myself into money.
Yeah.
But that said, are you going to go and see Now You See Me?
Yes. Yes, I am.
And so am
I. Opening day, probably.
And so am I. If people want to catch your podcast, it's The Weekly Planet.
Oh, it's called The Weekly Planet. It's on iTunes. It's about movies and TV shows and comic books, as all podcasts are. It's about movies and TV shows.
And
myself and my friend James, we talk about all that sort of stuff. You know.
And if you would like a good place to start, why not start with episode 90, which is
That the one you're on?
Is that the one where you and I talk about
Terminator Genesis, yeah.
From using my expert opinion as a magician and con artist.
That's right, yeah. In many ways, us seeing that was the greatest con of all.
Oh, you got it in there in the end.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No worries, buddy.
As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.